Let me invite you to turn to 1 Samuel chapter 16. If you have a Bible, then I would invite you to turn there. If you don't, I'm going to read it, so it's okay if you just want to listen. And if you want to use the Bible that's in the rack in front of you, 304 would be the page to turn to in the Bible that's in the chair racks. Now, the text on which this morning's teaching is based from 1 Samuel 16 marks a very significant point, very significant shift in our winter study that we've been doing about the earliest days of the monarchy in ancient Israel. Because in 1 Samuel 16, we meet for the very first time one of the most famous characters in all of ancient history, and that's David. And one person, I didn't try to verify or whatever, one person says, of all ancient literature, there's the most narrative about David. If you kind of start here and you go through his life and his reign, the most written, the most number of words than any other character in ancient history. And so let me invite you to stand if you're able, and I'm going to read the first 13 verses of chapter 16. And then when I'm done, I'm going to make the statement that this is the word of the Lord. And this is simply just a public acknowledgement that what we are reading here is not from me, okay? Right? It's from God. It's written down. It's preserved for our benefit. And then, after I say that, I'm going to invite you to respond by saying, thanks be to God. And this is an expression on your part, an expression of worship, really, recognizing the gift that we have in the Bible. So right here, here we go. 1 Samuel chapter 16, verses 1 to 13. The Lord said to Samuel, how long will you grieve over Saul since I have rejected him from being king over Israel? Fill your horn with oil and go. I will send you to Jesse the Bethlehemite, for I have provided for myself a king among his sons. And Samuel said, how can I go? If Saul hears it, he'll kill me. And the Lord said, take a heifer with you and say, I've come to sacrifice to the Lord. And invite Jesse to the sacrifice, and I will show you what you shall do, and you shall anoint for me him whom I declare to you. Samuel did what the Lord commanded and came to Bethlehem. The elders of the city came to meet him trembling and said, do you come peaceably? And he said, peaceably. I've come to sacrifice to the Lord. Consecrate yourselves and come with me to the sacrifice. And he consecrated Jesse and his sons, and he invited them to the sacrifice. When they came, he looked on Eliab and thought, surely the Lord's anointed is before him. But the Lord said to Samuel, do not look on his appearance or on the height of his stature, because I have rejected him. For the Lord sees not as man sees. Man looks on the outward appearance, but the Lord looks on the heart. Then Jesse called Abinadab and made him pass before Samuel. And he said, neither has the Lord chosen this one. Then Jesse made Shammah pass by. And he said, neither has the Lord chosen this one. And Jesse made seven of his sons pass before Samuel. And Samuel said to Jesse, the Lord has not chosen these. Then Samuel said to Jesse, are all your sons here? And he said, there remains yet the youngest, but behold, he's keeping the sheep. And Samuel said to Jesse, send and get him, for we will not sit down until he comes here. And he sent and brought him in. Now he was ruddy and had beautiful eyes and was handsome. And the Lord said, arise, anoint him, for this is he. Then Samuel took the horn of oil and anointed him in the midst of his brothers. And the Spirit of the Lord rushed upon David, and from that day forward. And Samuel rose up and went to Ramah. This is the word of the Lord. And please be seated. Now, here's the very tempting thing to do with this passage. Right? What's tempting is to view this whole scene in light of our nation's current political situation, and that's natural. And in fact, in some ways, I'm probably partially to blame for the tendency that we might have initially to look at this, because I told you that one of the reasons why we chose 1 Samuel to study during the first part of this year is because we're as a nation in the midst of a presidential election, and so let's look at a biblical text that talks a great deal about choosing national leaders, right? And so it's tempting to kind of want to do that, like, yeah, let's line up the candidates, just kind of like how Samuel did. But I don't want to do that. I don't want to do that this morning, right? Because actually, I think that would be way too easy for for us, because it would occupy our entire time thinking about what the passage means for other people. Have you ever had that tendency? Have you ever sat and listened to, and maybe me, maybe someone else, and your first thought is, I wish so-and-so were here to hear this. Right? So-and-so so needs to hear what Tom is talking about. If only so-and-so, right? No. I mean, that's fine. I mean, and you should be thinking about who you should, you know, invite and who you'd like to be here. But I don't want us to do that, right? Right? There's no question here that the central anchor statement of the passage is the second part of verse 7, where God says to Samuel, the Lord sees not as man sees. Man looks on the outward appearance, but the Lord looks on the heart. And because this is a highly dramatic scene about picking the next king, it's really tempting what might it mean if we're evaluating, you know, the candidates lined up at the next debate. But I don't want to let myself off the hook that easily. Right? And I don't think you should want to let yourself off the hook either. I don't want to let you off the hook, right? Because what God is calling us here, I think, is to not so much evaluate someone else, but evaluate your own heart, that is. Right? Evaluate your own heart. God looks on the heart. And that's what I want you to have in mind, right? So as we look through this text this morning, right? Like you're looking through a microscope, right? That's how I want you to turn the knob. Right? That's how I want you to adjust the fine focus. I want you to adjust the fine focus so that as you look through the microscope at this text, you see your own heart. And what we're going to do, what we'll use to sort of turn the knobs as we walk through this text, are three headings, and they're printed on the back of the bulletin if you kind of want to follow along. All right, those are going to be the tools we use to kind of turn the knobs. Heading number one, and it's really verses 1-3, hope from despair. Heading number two, and this is really verses 4-10, looking in the wrong places. And you know, knob number three, right? Verses 11-13, finding the true king. Right? There's three headings, three sort of knobs that we'll use to adjust the fine focus and look at our hearts. Hope from despair, looking in the wrong places, and finding the true king. Now first, hope from despair. Look again at verse 1. The Lord said to Samuel, how long will you grieve over Saul since I have rejected him from being king over Israel? Now, this picks up, if you were here last week, this picks up a similar theme that was evident in chapter 15 that we didn't really have time to deal with in any kind of depth. But when King Saul, the current king, when he disregarded God's command, the command that had been communicated to him by the prophet Samuel, when he disobeyed that command, Samuel, it says, was grieved at the fall of Saul. In fact, it wasn't just Samuel. It says that the Lord himself felt regret about the kingship of Saul. Now, wait a minute, you say. Right? Weren't these the guys who are responsible for making him king in the first place? Right? Isn't the Lord the one who's responsible for Saul being king? Right? But it's true. If you think about this, it's true. Even when you see it coming, even when you know something tragic is going to happen, even when you know it's deserved, maybe, that what's going to happen, the consequences can still lead you to sorrow, can still lead you to grieve over what's happening, right? For example, a few years ago, a woman named Kristen Hanna wrote a book called The Nightingale. Maybe you've heard of it. It was a New York Times bestseller. I think it was the Wall Street Journal Book of the Year, fiction book, but historical fiction, about two French sisters during World War II who experienced extreme suffering, extreme loss, extreme grief. And because it's such an emotional book, when she was being interviewed by a book reviewer on a television program, right, she was asked if, you know, when you write, it's an interesting question to ask the author, right? When you write a story like this that can evoke so much emotion, can bring tears to your eyes, right, do you ever cry? Like, do you ever cry as you're writing? And she said, you know, actually, like, no, not regularly. She said, but with this book, particularly for the last 50 to 75 pages. And she said, I must have reread it dozens of times after I wrote it. She said, I've never been able to read it, these last 50 to 75 pages. I've never been able to read it without becoming emotional myself. Now remember, she's the author. She wrote the book. She knows what's going to happen, right? She formed the plot. There isn't anything that happens that she didn't make happen. And presumably, she didn't make happen because she felt that that was the best, the right way for the story to unfold, right? And yet she gets emotional. That makes sense, though, right? The author of the story can ordain the way that things will happen, and it can be the very best way for those events to unfold, and yet still grieve and be saddened by the emotion of the situation that is found in the unfolding of the storyline. Now, if a human author can feel that, is able to experience this, then certainly God is able to simultaneously write the perfect storyline and still be grieved by the sadness required by the story's perfection. And that's what you have here, right? In the best sense, that's what Samuel might be experiencing as well. He's experiencing grief over the way that things have turned out. Saul was supposed to be a great king. It was supposed to go well, right? There were glimpses of promise, right? Samuel had invested so much into him, and now it's nothing. Now it's gone. But there is also a sense, so I think that's part, it's definitely the way the Lord kind of views the regret of the situation. There's a sense in which it's the way Samuel views it, but there's also a sense in which the legitimate grief, which is always appropriate, becomes for Samuel a wrong-headed despair, right? Which is why you have God correcting Samuel and telling him to knock it off, right? Now, where does despair come from in a situation like this? Right, in a situation like Samuel, where does despair come from? Where does it kind of move from a legitimate sense of sorrow and grief and emotion about the way things have turned out and turn into hopeless despair? Well, it comes from an ungrounded worry that Samuel may have had in this situation, or maybe you've experienced as well, an ungrounded worry that just because you can't see how the story will continue to unfold from this point forward, right? Just because you can't see it, despair comes from assuming that there must not be then, because you can't see it, that there must not be any continuation of the story. Or if there is, it's certainly not a continuation that you'd like. That's where despair comes from. Assuming that because because you can't see the continued unfolding of the storyline, that there isn't an unfolding, continued unfolding of the storyline, and that if you could see it, you wouldn't like it. And that's where Samuel finds himself. A moment of darkness where the clock is ticking on the monarchy, right? He can't see what's next. He can't see what's in front of him. It's like a deep sea diver at 200 feet, right? A deep sea diver who's lost sight of the anchor line and who's running out of oxygen, right? Have you ever felt like that? I mean, maybe not like deep sea diving, but have you ever had that sort of panic that comes because the life plan isn't unfolding exactly the way that you expected it to unfold. And you can't see your way back to the surface. You don't know which way is which. And you're not sure how much longer you're going to be able to stay below water because you're watching the clock and the oxygen's running out. And see, this is where the word of the Lord comes. That's what happened to Samuel. This is what happened to Samuel. The word of the Lord speaks into the darkness. It's a light in the darkness. The Lord speaks into the despair and tell Samuel that while Samuel might not know what happens next, the Lord does. He knows what's next. He's got a person in mind, and he's got a plan to get him there. Right? Verse 1, he tells Samuel that he has provided for himself a king. That's what it says. I've provided for myself a king. Now, that's a good literal translation of the thought, but it misses some of the poetic effect of the Hebrew, which literally says that the Lord has seen for himself a king. He's seen it. Right? And there's a little trace of the idea in the English language, isn't there, in that word to see for yourself a king? Right? When we talk about an important task and we tell someone, right, see to it. Right? Or we respond when someone kind of, you know, tells us to do something, we'll say, I'll see that it gets handled. Right? That's what God's doing. He saw himself a king. Right, which reminds us then that even in the midst of the darkness, God is never blind. He sees. He saw. Now he can regret the consequences of the sinful world, but he's never surprised by them. He sees, but both in a passive and in an active sense. He sees in that he knows what's going to happen next, but he also sees in the sense that he is going to set out to. He's going to see to it. He's going to accomplish that which will, what will happen next. He's got a king in mind, and he's got a plan for revealing him. All right, so that's point number one. Our hearts are prone to despair because the world around us is it can be a scary place. It can be a dark place. And because we don't know what's next, we often feel as if we can't find our way back to the anchor line. And life for most of us then becomes the quest for looking for something to rescue us. Our previous king has failed. Whatever we've looked to previously for our rescue, for our light in the midst of darkness, that king has failed, and we've got to find the next king. Now the problem, point number two, right, knob number two, the problem is that we're looking in the wrong place. Verses 4 to 10 describe this. It's actually a pretty dramatic kind of scene, right? You can picture it. If you were making a movie, this would storyboard really well. Right? God tells Samuel to go to Bethlehem and visit the home of Jesse, right? And he tells him practically how to do it, what you should bring. This is pragmatically how you should say it, all that kind of stuff. And he shows up in Bethlehem, and it's interesting. The first thing the elders of the town kind of say is they're scared when he arrives, right? Do you come in peace? Do you come in peace? Now, what that means, obviously, I mean, Samuel's a pretty famous prophet. He's been around for a long time. He's not a new guy on the scene, right? He's not a rookie prophet, but obviously, right? Obviously, this wasn't on Samuel's sort of normal circuit. Bethlehem was probably not of the high-level town that sort of necessitated his normal route of ministry and performing sacrifices and stuff. Right? And so they weren't used to seeing him. Now, maybe it's the same kind of feeling when you walked in this morning, you saw three police officers standing in the back, right? Do they come in peace, right? Yes, yes. Samuel and the police, right? They come in peace. Now, right? Samuel tells them what they're going to do. He says, "Let's get washed up. Right? We're going to have a sacrifice, and after the sacrifice, you always have a big meal. And maybe while the meal's cooking, let's have a look at the candidates for king." And it says, verse 6, that he takes one look at Eliab, and his response is, "This is the one. Surely this is the one. This is the Lord's anointed." That's the word that's used there. It's Messiah. This is the one. Now it doesn't say here, but in 1 Chronicles 2, it does list Eliab as the oldest son, right? And that would make sense, both from Jesse's point of view and from Samuel's point of view. The oldest son would probably make the most sense, right? He'd be the one most likely to inherit the greatest wealth, right? We heard the kids kind of say, like, that might be a good qualification in the king, to have some kind of resources to be able to use as he's king, right? He was tall. He was handsome, right? Felt right. All the externals, they just kind of seemed right. But, of course, that was the problem. And that's the problem with each of the sons, Abinadab, Shema, the rest, seven of them in total, with each one of them, right? Jesse, the dad, kind of basically saying, like, how about this one? Right? And the Lord telling Samuel, nah, they're not the one. Keep going. Which is what, you know, and look at the explanation then in verse 7, right, about why they kept getting it wrong. God says to Samuel, man looks on the outward appearance, but the Lord looks on the heart. Now, if you think about it, you can see how this fits for us, right, for you individually. And you can use the knob to kind of turn and focus in on you. Because a focus on an outward appearance over the inner heart of a person, it's not only the root of so much of our unhappiness. Right? It actually very often at the same time is the false king to which we turn in the midst of our unhappiness. Say that again, right? This focus that we have individually, culturally speaking, on the external appearance rather than on the inner character of the heart. Not only is it the root, the cause of so much of our unhappiness, it actually becomes the false king to which we turn to save us from our unhappiness. Right? Let me say it a little differently. Right? It's relatively easy to observe the things like racism, you know, or eating disorders, or pornography, or materialism. It's relatively easy to observe these things and kind of say they're the result of a cultural obsession with outward appearance. Right? That makes sense, right? Racism, probably the biggest example of judging someone not on their internal character, but on their external characteristic, the color of their skin, right? Eating disorders are fueled by an obsession by some people, right? But to fit into a cultural mold that says you have to look a certain way, right? And pornography. Right? Tim Keller actually borrows Martin Luther King's line about having a dream that one day we'll be judged by the content of our character, not the color of our skin. He borrows that line, and he actually says that line actually hits on the fundamental core issue of pornography, right? The disembodying of a person's soul from their body, right? And creating a whole universe where we categorize, rate, rank, and discard people based on their outward appearance. Right? So that's all true. It's all true. But, and this is what I want you to see as well, not only are these things examples of how we focus on outward appearance, these things are fueled by a misguided attempt to find something to protect us when we're scared. We instinctually go to the false king of outward appearance when we feel that sense of darkness. Right? Think about it. When does racism tend to flare in a culture? Right? During periods of economic uncertainty, right? During periods of transition, when people are afraid, right? It was true in Nazi Germany, certainly on a big scale, that's the easiest kind of thing to look at, but it's been true to one degree or another at flex points, hinge points in all of American history, right? All cultural and economic transition, periods of uncertainty, periods of darkness tend to breed racist behavior because we instinctually go back to that and say, if I can just be around people like me, if I can just be around people who look like me, maybe everything will be okay. And we instinctually turn to that and we kind of look, maybe this is the king. Right? Think about it differently, right? When does an inappropriate relationship with our bodies and food, when does that become most aggravated? When is the temptation to view pornography the strongest? Right? It's when we feel the emptiness. It's when we feel the results from the failure of any other king to protect us. It's when we feel the uncertainty about what's next. Right? It's then that we go and we turn to those things and we look for them. We look at them and we say, maybe this is the king. And as one of the commentators points out, right, it's always easy for a culture to kind of say, like, it's worse than it's ever been. Well, it's always been bad. There's always things that you can look at as, you know, that in any one particular era you can say, well, it was worse then. Right? But it is true that there are at least two broad cultural trends that sort of aggravate this, I think, today, that ought to make us aware of our tendency to do this and are useful for us in our fight against it, right? The first cultural trend today is technological. In the 1980s, the NYU professor Neil Postman wrote a book called Amusing Ourselves to Death. This is 1980s, right? He was talking about television and those kinds of things. But he, in the book, he references the famous Lincoln-Douglas debates of 1858, right? These were the seven debates between the incumbent senator from Illinois, Stephen Douglas, and this upstart lawyer, Abraham Lincoln, and they became instantly famous, right? Nationally known because of the wire services and stuff, like the text of these debates were printed, and they were popular because they were an in-depth discussion of the issues of the day, slavery and states' rights and all those kinds of things, and the debates got published far and wide. But Postman points out that despite the fact that the names and the arguments would have been recognizable, right? These two men could have walked down the street of virtually any major city in America and to almost everyone be absolutely unrecognizable. Why? I mean, the photograph had been invented, but there were no wire services. There's no way to transmit photos. They didn't live in a world where the external image was as easily accessible. So when that happens, when you don't, what do you do? What do you focus on? How do these men become known? By their ideas. That's harder today. That's technological. Now the second major aggravating factor is philosophical, because in the post-Enlightenment Western culture, we have maybe the first culture in history to have no consensus about what right or wrong is. no consensus of, it's no inner anchor for rightness and wrongness. And what happens if you have no internal measuring stick for right and wrong? Right? What happens if you have no internal definition for judging moral character or something like that? Well, if you have no internal definition of judging moral character, then all you're left with is the external. That's all you have left. It's the only thing that by default you can use to judge. So now God, by contrast, verse 7 says, we've said this before, God looks on the heart. Now, the fact that God looks on the heart can either be comforting or extremely disconcerting, probably both, right? Just to define terms, right? Make sure we know what we mean by the heart. Now, obviously we're not talking about the, you know, in a medical sense here, the organ that pumps blood through our bodies, right? Neither, though, are we talking about the heart as the center of emotion, right? Valentine's Day, lots of hearts, right? As if we were to draw a line in that kind of case between the heart and the brain, right? The brain thinks, the heart feels. That's kind of the cultural kind of distinction that we would have. That's not the ancient understanding of the heart. The ancient understanding of the heart is really what we would refer to as both mind and, you know, both thinking and emotion. I like the phrase that Paul Tripp uses. He says, the heart is the causal core of our personhood. It is the causal core. Now, by that he means, right, is that it is the part that makes you, and it is the part that causes you to think what you think and do what you do. It's the causal core of your personhood. Now, to elaborate even more, what Paul Tripp would say is that the thing that structures, the thing that shapes, the thing that controls your behavior and your words is not the situations and the people around you. It's not the external things. That's not what controls you. Right? The thing that shapes and controls your words and your actions comes from inside you. It's your heart. Right? And this, the heart, is what God sees. And like I just said, that can either be very, very comforting or very unsettling. For example, right, if you're someone who has maybe never fared particularly well, comparatively speaking, by being judged by outward appearance. Maybe physically you've always kind of felt that, right? You don't have the flashy features of a supermodel or something like that. Maybe you don't have the wealth. Maybe you don't have the big job or something like that. Maybe you don't have the quick wit. Maybe you don't always have the right word to say in the social situation that would be fitting. Maybe you don't have any of those kinds of things. Well, then the fact that God doesn't look primarily at those things actually can be very comforting. Because God says, I'm not ultimately judging on any of those things. I'm looking at the heart. Psalm 24, 3 and 4. Who shall ascend the hill of the Lord, and who shall stand in his holy place? He who has clean hands and a pure heart. That's what God looks at. Now, on the other hand, though, if you think about that statement, all of us, to one degree or another, should consider the fact that God looks on the heart and be very, very concerned. Right, because the more you think about it, the more you consider yourself, the more that you begin to realize that there is no fearsome statement that you can possibly hear than the statement that the Lord looks not on external appearance, but the Lord looks on the heart. All right, just do this as an exercise. You've got two options, option A and option B, right? Option A, you have to spend the entire day with someone you don't like at all and someone who doesn't like you. Right? Just imagine your worst enemy or someone that you just really dislike. You have to spend the entire day with them. Now, they can't hurt you or anything like that physically, right? But all they can see, importantly, right? All they get to see is the outward appearance, right? They don't get to look inside your heart. You have to spend the whole day with them, but all they get to see is the outward appearance. That's option A. Now, option B, you spend the entire day with your very best friend. But you have a little digital recorder during that entire day that records every single thing you think. Every thought you have, everything, right? It reads everything. Everything you observe, right? Every action you take, it transcribes what you really thought about everything you do. It transcribes everything that you thought about that other person, even as you're talking to them. about their statements. And at the end of the day, you have to sit and listen to this other person read back to you this transcript of your every thought of the day. Now, which option do you choose, option A or option B? I would bet that no matter how much of us would want to choose option B, we'd much rather spend time with our very best friend or someone, right? No matter how much of us would want to choose option B, I would bet that the risk that you would have to take of what they would learn about you from that recording, of what they might see if they really looked on your heart, would be too great for you to take that option. And you choose option A instead, much safer. Man looks on the outward appearance, but the Lord looks on the heart. So what do? I mean, we're sort of stuck in the middle, right? We realize that trying to save ourselves from the darkness is futile, right? If we pursue kings that kind of look like, by outward appearance, what we might want, they're not going to satisfy our need. They're not going to give us the security that we really crave. They're not going to be able to live up to the promises that they make. They're not going to be able to satisfy the deepest desires of our heart, right? And yet, being rescued by the true king that looks on the heart, is actually scary because we know our own heart. So what do we do? Well, point number three, finding the true king, right? Knob number three, find focus. Verses 11 to 13. We have this scene where Samuel calls him out on the fact that he has one more son. And Samuel says to Jesse, "All your sons here?" And Jesse says, "Well, no, I mean, there's one more. There's the youngest, but I mean, he's off keeping the sheep. That's what we got him doing." Now, this is interesting, isn't it, right? The very important representative of royalty has arrived on this very important mission. This big special sacrifice has been offered. This big, very important meal is being prepared. And while they're waiting for everything to cook, they're playing this game basically of trying Cinderella's glass slipper on all of the, stepsisters. That's what they're doing. Doesn't fit, right? All the while, right, while Cinderella isn't even invited to the ball. She's not even there. It hadn't even occurred to Jesse that David could be the one that Samuel wanted to see. Right? He's the youngest. And this word, youngest, the Hebrew word for youngest, could also be translated smallest. Right? But even that misses the sense of disdain that's kind of in this word. The Hebrew scholar, Robert Alter, he's been a professor of Hebrew since 1967 at the University of California, Berkeley. Not usually considered to be a stronghold of faith, but he's a first-rate Hebrew scholar. And he says that this word sort of combines the idea of youth and small stature with a person's inconsequentiality. Right? I heard someone else kind of offer, an English word sort of that would capture this sense. David was the runt. He's the runt. He's the youngest, he was the smallest, and he's the least consequential. Now, as a result, he's treated, isn't he, as if he doesn't even exist. He's the eighth son, right? What's the Hebrew number? What's the kind of ancient number of completion? Seven. He's not even in the number. He's completely on the outside. And Robert Alter says, David then is kind of a male Cinderella, left to his domestic chores instead of being invited to the party. And therefore, Alter says, what you have in David is actually something that's very consistent with God's character. He says, this is a continuation of the theme of the reversal of primogeniture that dominates Genesis. That's a big word, but hold on, I'll explain what it means. Instead of an elder brother or even a younger brother of the seven sons, David is the eighth child and therefore not even there at all. See, what Robert Alter is saying is this. He's saying that what's happening here with David is a continuation of the way God works. Right? He makes deliberate choices to bless the one who wouldn't appear on the outside to be the logical choice. And this is the way that God has consistently worked through all the... Hey, he chooses a bunch of nomads. Right? This tribe of Noah. This is going to be my chosen people. He doesn't choose Egypt. He doesn't choose the great civilization of Mesopotamia. He chooses old, infertile Sarah rather than young, fertile Hagar to bear the promised child, Isaac. Right? He chooses Jacob, not Esau. Right? He chooses the kingly tribe of Judah. It doesn't come from the beautiful wife Rachel that Jacob so adored. It comes from Leah, the never wanted wife of Jacob. This is how God works, because God wants to make it very, very clear that whom he chooses for his glory. Now, truth be told, it does tell us here that David was pretty good looking, which is just a good kind of caveat. God's not against handsome people. He's not anti outward appearance, right? There's nothing wrong with pursuing beauty. He's a God of beauty, right? There's nothing wrong with it. But what it's saying is that our problem is we focus on that as the judge rather than the inner heart. Now, here's the thing: everyone kind of knows that, you know, that we shouldn't judge the inside by the outside, right? Anyone seen the new Mary Poppins movie? Right? Emily Blunt knows that, right? She sings a song about it, right? If you read between the lines, you'll find your first impression was mistook, for a cover is nice, but a cover is not the book, right? Don't judge a book by its cover, right? It's common for people to understand that, right? We resonate with the sentiment. The problem is we're absolutely powerless to actually do anything about it. We can say, don't judge a cover by its book, but we still do it. Why? Because the reason why we do it is our hearts are wrong. We're ultimately and completely incapable of changing our ability to look at the heart because there's something wrong with ours. No earthly king will do that, will help us, will solve that problem, including David. Right? I mean, David was commendable because when David ends up failing spectacularly, right? David, he repents, he owns it, right? But make no mistake about it, David will fail spectacularly, right? And David is absolutely powerless to change your heart. Buried in the Old Testament is a small book written by a prophet named Micah. He lived hundreds of years after David. And in Micah chapter 5, this is what he writes. Listen, he says, "But you, O Bethlehem, Ephrathah, O Bethlehem, who are too little to be among the clans of Judah, from you shall come forth for me one who is to be ruler in Israel, whose coming forth is from of old, from ancient days." The prophet Micah, he says a ruler is going to come out of Bethlehem, and he can't be talking about David because David's been dead for hundreds of years. He's talking about the Messiah. He's talking about the ultimate anointed one. Right? A king who would come out of Bethlehem to rule Israel, who would be both the ancient one, the one from of ancient days, and the anointed one. Right? He's talking about Jesus. And in this one, in this anointed one, in Jesus, we finally have the king we need, right? Who can solve our problem, the problem of being frustrated with the failure of the outward to satisfy us on the one hand, and yet on the other hand, being scared to trust our hearts to the king because our hearts are bad. We finally have one in this anointed one who can do something about that. See, the only way to change our obsession with outward appearance is to know that it comes from a profound sense of emptiness on our part that can only be filled when we look upon a superior beauty, right? A superior beauty that knows that this ancient one, this Jesus, is also the anointed one. Right? The other child from Bethlehem, who wasn't allowed in but was kept out with the sheep, remember? Jesus. Right? The other one who was anointed by the Spirit of God and sent into the wilderness. Now, David was sent into the wilderness because he was being chased by Saul. He was being hunted by Saul. Jesus would go into the wilderness after being anointed by the Spirit because he was being attacked by Satan. Right? This other son, who was not just forgotten by his father on feast day, but this son, the ultimate son, the anointed one, this one utterly forsaken by his father on the cross. Right? Our emptiness can only be filled by the most radiant person in the universe who was reduced for us to what amounted to an externally appearing horror. In Isaiah 53, it speaks of the suffering that Jesus would endure. And it says, he had no form or majesty that we should look at him, and no beauty that we should desire him. He was despised and rejected by men as one from whom men hide their faces. And yet in this one who experienced the ultimate disfigurement, the ultimate horror of external appearance, in this one is the way for our heart to be fixed. Because you see, in what Jesus suffered, he arranges for a transaction that fixes our heart. See, we do our best to keep up appearances on the outside, but we're hideous on the inside. Jesus, on the other hand, was perfect on the inside, but he was willing to become hideous on the outside. Do you see? In other words, what he did on the cross was he transferred his perfect, beautiful heart to ours. He arranged for the switch. I'll take the external ugliness and give you the internal beauty. So that when God looks at our heart then, because he does, the Lord looks on the heart. But when that transaction has been accomplished on our behalf, and when we receive it by placing our faith in Jesus, when that happens and God looks upon our heart, he doesn't see the hideous, ugly one. He sees the perfect, beautiful heart of his son. Micah chapter 5, verse 4. And he, speaking of this ultimate son of Bethlehem, he shall stand and shepherd his flock in the strength of the Lord, in the majesty of the name of the Lord his God, and they shall dwell secure. For now he shall be great to the ends of the earth, and he shall be their peace. Do you feel the darkness? Do you feel the sense of unsettling, of not knowing what's next? None of the external kings will do. Only the one who is the greater son of Bethlehem is able to give you this peace. Let's pray. Our Father, thank you. Thank you that you have made it possible for you to look on our heart and not recoil in horror. Lord, we know what's there, but oh, to accept the great promise that Jesus offers, that the heart that comes to him will be transplanted, will be changed. A heart of flesh removed, the heart of stone removed and the heart of flesh implanted. A heart that desires you. Oh, Lord, may that be true for us, and that this gospel might be proclaimed through us as a result. In Jesus' name, amen. You know, it is true.